So at the very beginning, I want to apologize to those who were away on the youth activity break, because we looked at this passage at the youth activity break, and I'm going to use the same story at the beginning of my sermon tonight that I used then. But please, young people who are away, don't switch off, because there's lots of other stuff that we're going to be looking at in this passage. The story that I told then was about a department store in New York that had been broken into. But it wasn't your average burglary that was carried out. The burglars that particular evening stole nothing. Nothing was wrecked or destroyed in any way in the store. Nothing was even moved in the store except for one thing. The only thing that was moved was the price tags. High-end items like barbecues and golf clubs received low-value price tags. And low-value items like socks and underwear received the prices normally placed on suits and overcoats. The next day, the staff just came in as usual. And since there was no mess, they were entirely oblivious to what had actually happened during the closing hours of the store. In fact, nobody noticed anything until lunchtime. Some shoppers received the bargain of a lifetime, and others walked out in utter disgust at what had happened in the store. High-end prices going for low-end values. You know, this is the very trick that the devil plays on us as well. He has made the low-end things of life seem more valuable than the real things, the important things, the things of real worth. Just think about our world today. We should value things like love and loyalty and honesty and humility and thoughtfulness and decency. But our world today values other things. It tells us that we should value things like getting ahead, fighting for our rights, having a good time, even if that has to be at the expense of others. Our world says that we should be pleasing ourselves no matter what. You see, the devil has sold us this lie regarding what is really of value. This passage talks about valuing what really is important. And as we look at it tonight, I'm going to take three very simple points, and you'll see why they're very simple points, because they're right there in the passage. The first thing I want us to look at tonight is a treasure. A treasure. I want to ask you a question, and I want you all to answer it. Where do you hide your valuables? I haven't heard any answers yet. Where do you hide your valuables? Honestly, you're not telling me anything. I want a list at the door and the safety deposit numbers. No, I'm only joking you. We understand the principle that if you have something of value, that you got to put it somewhere where you're sure it's going to be safe. We don't tend to bury things in the ground today. But that was very much the common practice back in the first century. We tend to put our money in a saving and loans company or into a bank or into a safety deposit box. It's only those who maybe still think they're living in a former generation who hide the money underneath their pillow or put it somewhere else. You're probably not very wise to do those things. Just the other day, William was telling the story of John Joe Rainey. I'm sure you've heard this one. You've heard many stories about, do you remember who John Joe Rainey was? Yeah, I knew you would. But John Joe had some money, and he was going away on holiday, and he had to decide what he was going to do with it. So he put it underneath the hearth in the fireplace. Have you heard this one? Okay, I'm going to pretend you haven't. Put it anyway under the hearth in the fireplace. The rest of you are working ahead on this. He went away off on holiday, and he came back, and it was a wee bit cooler, and he lit the fire, and it was the most expensive fire that he ever had. We know that that just isn't wise to do. You don't put your money someplace like that. You hide it away somewhere that you can trust in. But back in the days of first century Middle Eastern life, they didn't have mattresses that they could hide it under, and so they buried it. And this was especially true in Palestine because it was a place of frequent warfare. Burying their valuables protected them against any enemies who might raid their homes and try to steal everything. And so over the years, the land of Palestine became a veritable treasure trove. In fact, what tended to happen was that people maybe died, they were sent off into battle, or else they ended up being exiled, like in the time whenever Israel was taken over by Babylon. And so somebody else would come in at a later stage, and maybe whenever they were plowing the ground or whenever they were just digging the ground, they would find somebody else's treasure. So Jesus' parable describes a very feasible situation. I don't know about you when you're reading this parable, but I always had a real issue with it. To me, it seemed dishonest. I know as children we used to say, finders, keepers, what was the other bit? Losers. I've just suddenly taken you back to your childhood, haven't I? Finders, keepers, losers, weepers. That's what we used to say when we were children. But when we grew up, we knew that you couldn't do that. That if you found something of value, that it more than likely belonged to someone else and you needed to find the person that it belonged to, or else you could have a policeman standing at your door. And so we struggle with this parable. Because it seems on the surface that this guy comes along, he digs a hole in the ground, he finds this valuable treasure, he covers over it, and then he goes to the man who owns the land, he doesn't tell him anything about the treasure that he has just found, and he buys the land so that he can get this treasure. Obviously the land is going to be cheaper for him than the value of what he knows is buried under the ground. So it seems dishonest. Have you ever had that problem in the passage? Well, I did. I'm going to tell you the solution that I found to it. There was a law that the rabbis taught, and here's what it said. If a man finds scattered fruit or money, it belongs to the finder. So it was understood that if you found treasure buried in the ground somewhere, that it belonged to you. You find it, it's yours. So this guy didn't actually need to go to the owner of the field and pay him money for the field. He simply could have taken the treasure, put it under his arm, and headed off to, I was going to say the Bahamas, that's not the best place to head off to at the minute, but he would have headed off to some lovely location. It's out of the decency of his heart that he goes to buy the man's field. So really the man who found the treasure was extremely honest. But I don't want us to lose sight of the main point of the parable. The main point of the parable is this. A man found something so valuable that he sold everything in order to get it. It's interesting that this treasure is hidden in the ground. It's not sitting on the surface, it's hidden underground. John Calvin said something interesting. He said, "We commonly set a high value on what is visible, and therefore the new and spiritual life which is held out to us in the gospel is little esteemed by us because it is hidden and lies in hope." You see, if someone were to say to me today, "What is it that I live for?" I would say to them, "Well, I live for God." "Well, where is he? Can I see him?" "No, I can't show you God." "What are you looking forward to?" I say, "Well, I'm looking forward to heaven." "Well, where is it? Can I see?" "No, sorry, I can't show you heaven." So today, what is of inestimable value to me is something that I can't show anybody in a physical sense. But our world today values the things that they can hold in their hands, enjoys the possessions that they can live in and drive in and look at. They enjoy the things that are very tangible and they see in front of them. So the things that are invisible are not of value, and the things that are visible are of value. But this man found this treasure that was hidden. And the message is clear, that the kingdom of heaven is worth more to a believer than anything and everything else. Is this so for you? Is this how it is for you? That the kingdom of heaven is worth everything that you have and so much more. A treasure. Then secondly, I want us to see a pearl. We find this in verses 45 and 46. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything that he had, and he bought it. Marilyn Monroe, a fine singer, maybe depends on what your taste may be, but I'm sure you know where I'm going to go with this. But she once sang a song. She sang, "The French are glad to die for love. They delight in fighting duels. But I prefer a man who lives and gives expensive jewels. A kiss on the hand may be quite..." Oh my word, you don't know that. "A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but..." Oh, you know that bit. "Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Not if you're a girl in the Middle East." Their preference wasn't diamonds or rubies or garnets or anything like that. Not at all. Their interest was in pearls. These beautiful, untouched pearls. The more wealthy you were, the more pearls you wore. The Egyptians worshipped the pearl. The Romans actually put the pearls into a glass, poured vinegar into them, and diluted the pearls, and then drank them. Does that sound nice? No, I don't fancy the idea myself. I imagine it would give you kidney stones and all sorts of other things as well. But that was the extravagance of wealth. A wealthy man today might get himself one of those great big Havana cigars. I don't know how much they are. But it's a sign of his wealth, isn't it, whenever he sits and he puffs away on that cigar. Well, pearls was how you showed that you were wealthy in a former generation. Of course, one of the reasons why they were viewed to be so valuable was because it was so dangerous to get them. They were usually obtained from the Persian Gulf or the Indian Ocean. Divers had to descend 40 feet in order to be able to get them. There were no masks that you could wear back then. There was no equipment. And so it was a dangerous profession. That's why they were valuable. And here we read about a man who was a pearl dealer. Maybe he was a bit of a Del boy in his day. And he bought them cheap. And he sold them on more expensive. And this time he comes across a pearl that he wants for himself. And you can imagine him saying when he looks at this pearl and he maybe thinks, "This time next year, I'll be a millionaire." And he thinks, "If I can get this pearl, it is worth everything else that I have." So he sells everything. He sells his pearls. He sells his house. He sells his possessions. He sells everything because this pearl is the real deal. It's worth it. J.C. Ryle said, talking about a true Christian, he says, "A true Christian is what he is and does what he does in his religion because he is thoroughly persuaded that it's worthwhile. He comes out from the world. He puts off the old man. He forsakes the vain companions of his past life. He sees in Christ an endless treasure. He sees in Christ a precious pearl. To win Christ, he will make any sacrifice. This is true faith. This is the stamp of a genuine work of the Holy Spirit. Today it strikes me that many Christians are not prepared for a faith that may cost them something, let alone everything. And I wonder, is it because they have stopped valuing the kingdom of heaven as the greatest thing that they could ever look forward to? You know, a former generation had much more of the pilgrim spirit. They talked about this land as a place that we're just a passing through. This isn't the permanent. The permanent is what is to come. This isn't of value. What we see around us in this world, this is all passing away. But it's what is in heaven is permanent. And this parable is saying, let's learn to value the things from above. Again, J.C. Ryle comments, when a man will venture nothing for Christ's sake, we must draw the sorrowful conclusion that he has not got the grace of God. How much do you value salvation? Do you value it so much that you would give your life for your faith? A treasure, a pearl, and lastly, a net. Verse 47. Once again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was let down into the lake and caught all kinds of fish. Now, Jesus has been in a bit of a parable role over these past few chapters. He has just given them five parables, one after another, just hot on the heels of each other. And now he is about to deliver his sixth parable. He has told us parables about sowers, mustard seed, yeast, treasure, pearls. And now he tells us about fishing. I don't know an awful lot about fishing. I tried it once about 25 years ago, and it was a bit of a disaster. So if Jesus were here today and he was trying to get a message across to me, he'd probably be better not to use the analogies of fishing. He would probably talk to me about cars or something like that, and that's how he would get into me. And he would talk to William about football, and Brian about football as well, because that's how he would get to them. But here he talks to his hearers about fishing. By this stage, it looks likely that his audience was made up of his disciples, maybe a few others, but maybe not the scribes and Pharisees that he's had listening at other times. We would look at that, or we would see that from verses 51, 52, and around there. It would suggest that it seems to be just the disciples. And here he talks to them about fishing, something that they would understand. I don't think he was talking about a rod and a hook with a worm in the end. But I think that he's talking about fishing that uses what we would call a dragnet. When the net is full, it's pulled ashore, and then all the sorting begins. They're divided, even though there's all types of fish in it, they're divided into two groups. Just two groups. There's the good fish. We assume that they're put into a basket and then sent up to market. And then there's the bad fish. And they maybe throw them back into the sea, or they throw them into the dump, but they are discarded. The good fish and the bad fish. Today we may encourage many into the church, and there are people of all types and descriptions in our churches, but they all fall into one of two groups. The saved and the unsaved. We read about them over and over again in the parables, don't we? We read about the wheat and the tares, the sheep and the goats, now the good fish and the bad fish. The result is always the same. The good get a taste of heaven. The bad are condemned to hell. The message couldn't be any clearer. And Calvin speaks about the church that this parable is speaking of. And Calvin says the church of God, so long as it exists in the world, is a mixture of the good with the bad. And it is never free from stains and pollutions. He's talking here about the visible church. You see, when we go to our churches on a Sunday morning, that's the visible church. What is sitting in front of me tonight is the visible church. I hope you're all members of the invisible church as well. That's those who are true believers. I can't tell to look at you who's a true believer and who isn't. But the Lord knows. He sees your heart. You see, you can be a member of the visible church. You can be a communicant member in the visible church. You can be an elder in the visible church. And yet still not know Jesus Christ as your Savior. All of that is perfectly possible. And when this net is drawn to the shore, the fish are divided. The net, spiritually speaking, will soon be drawn to the shore. And the true character of each person will be known. And you may be successful today at pulling the wool over many people's eyes, but let me tell you this, you will not fool God. The Bible makes it clear that there is eternal separation between the good fish and the bad fish, between the wheat and the tares, between the believers and the unbelievers. There is eternal separation. Here we read that there is a furnace of fire for the wicked. We are told that there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I don't know if you've ever heard somebody wailing. You've maybe heard it in some of those funerals out in the Middle East where there's been some bomb or something and you hear one of the funerals and you hear people wailing. It's the most awful sound. It's dreadful. Can you imagine being in that for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks in the year, for all eternity? That's what hell is. And if that sound isn't enough, then there's also the sound of gnashing of teeth. I don't know if you've ever heard that sound. I have. And let me tell you, there's nothing that puts your nerves on edge as much as hearing the sound of somebody grinding their teeth. And hell is described as a place where people will be grinding their teeth. Why would you do that? Well, I don't know about you, but it's usually whenever you're in pain and agony, isn't it, you would grind your teeth. And this is hell. Forever. No let out for good behavior. No parole. No hoping that you just sort of pay the price for a short time and then get into heaven. No. It's forever. And today the fake Christians are sitting in the same pews, listening to the same sermons, singing the same hymns. But one day, they'll be separated from the true believers forever. What about you? Is your faith a genuine faith? Is what you show on the outside a picture of what has really happened in your heart? Jesus asks a question in verse 51. Pointedly says to the people, have you understood all these things? It's a good question, isn't it? I'm going to throw it out to you. Have you understood all these things tonight? Have you? Okay, you haven't. I'll have to start again. Have you understood all these things? I hope you do. Jesus asks the question, You know, I used to have a boss many years ago, and I only had him for a short time, and he used to preach a tremendous sermon. I mean, absolutely brilliant. And then whenever the clock would ding on 1 o'clock, he just suddenly would say, "Our closing hymn is." And he would stop before the application. He would stop before he sort of nailed it home. Some of you wish that I would just stop like that as well. But he just stopped. And you have no idea how frustrated I was. I felt like getting up and sort of finishing it off for him. And it was so frustrating. And you know, a sermon without application is, it's like posting a letter, but not putting an address on the outside of the envelope. And your writing may be terrific inside it. It may look absolutely beautiful. And the content of what you write may be very good, but unless it's got the address, it's not going to reach its destination. And when we preach, we got to make sure that there's the application. And Jesus wants to make sure that his application has got home here. You see, hearing a sermon will change no one if they don't understand what it means. So what do these parables speak about this evening? Well, they talk about true values, don't they? They talk about essential priorities. And they talk about eternal securities. Let me ask you, are you sure that you're going to heaven? Have you made God your priority in life? Does he mean everything to you? That's what it's all about. Verse 52 talks about him bringing out his treasure. And with this I'm finishing. It's like the owner of a house who brings out his storeroom new treasures as well as old. It's talking about someone who proclaims the truth of the kingdom, dealing with both the things that are older and well known and the things that are newer. And he brings this message. Let me ask you today, are you fishing? Are you a fisher of men? Are you working for the sake of the kingdom? One day a man came in with a boat full of fish. And the game warden was astonished and he asked the man, "How did you manage to catch so many fish?" Well, the man in the boat says to the warden, "Why don't you come with me and you'll see." So they rowed out into the middle of the lake. And as the boat sort of came to a rest, the warden was waiting for the man to get out his fishing rod. But instead of that, the man reached into this box at his feet and he pulled out a stick of dynamite. And he then got a match and he lit the dynamite and the warden started shouting, "Stop! You can't do that, man. This is no way to fish. What are you thinking?" Just at that, the man threw the stick of dynamite to the warden. "Are you going to sit there complaining or are you going to do some fishing?" And the poor man had nothing to do but to throw the stick of dynamite into the water. It's easy for us to complain, isn't it? To complain about the world in which we live, about the worldliness of the people that surround us, about the decisions that they make, the philosophies that they follow. So easy for us to complain about that. But let me ask you today, are you fishing? Are you working amongst them to share Jesus Christ with them? The net will be dragged to shore soon. And the time for dividing will begin. Let's get out there and warn the people to make sure that they're amongst the good fish and not the bad. A treasure, a pearl, and a net.